Welcome to the Business Exit Roundtable with Heath Franson, along with his guests, real experts with real ideas and actionable strategies for leveraging the wealth in your business. And now, here's the author of The Psychology of Money, the chairman of the Exit Planning Exchange, and founder and CEO of Delta Business Services, your host, Heath Franson.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Business Exit Roundtable. I'm your host, Heath Franson. You know, every once in a while, you come across someone whose ideas are so fresh, so intriguing, so useful, that you want to share them with everyone you know. Today, we are joined by someone just like that, a business leader whose vibrant, in-your-face approach to pitching deals, products, and services has been spelled out in his best-selling book, Pitch Anything, which is being used by business leaders worldwide to improve their pitch performance. As director of capital markets for investment bank Intersection Capital, Oren Claff is responsible for managing the firm's capital raising platform, which includes both direct capital raising and deal syndication. Oren oversees business development and product development and is responsible for the firm's flagship product, Velocity. Previously, Oren was a venture analyst and partner at several mid-sized investment funds. His book, Pitch Anything, was named as McGraw-Hill's most important business book of 2013. I recently spoke with Oren about how his Pitch Anything method can help business owners who want to sell their businesses. Listen up. This interview is awesome. I hope you enjoy it. Had to get you on the show, and let's have it out. First off, Oren, I love to give my listeners a little background on my guest. So can you tell us a little bit about who you are and how you got started in this incredible entrepreneurial journey that eventually birthed Pitch Anything?
Sure. So I'm the patron saint of tough deals, right? So through my career, I got handed really some tough capital raises, right? So where a company or my partner said, hey, we need $6 million and we need it in 35 days. We need $8 million and we need it in 40 days. We need $13 million and we need it in 29 days unless we'll lose, you know, otherwise we'll lose $2 million. So I was really in a large part of my career in very high stakes circumstances where you go in to pitch a deal to a group of investors and you get a yes or a no very quickly. And there's just not, you know, it's not like copier sales, nothing wrong with copier sales, but there's not, you know, 1,000 companies in your local market to go pitch, you know, your copier to. There's like 5 groups. You get 5 no's, mm-hmm. You're done, right? So these are high stakes environments. And what you find is in capital, banking, money, when you go in to give a pitch, it is the edges of human experience, like war, right? Or like UFC cage fighting. Like it's extreme situations. So the lessons that you learn in extreme situations can then be applied to everyday life. And so this is why I think Pitch Anything is such a phenomena, because I took what I learned in the heat of battle in finance at the edge of the of human extreme psychology and says, this is the way human beings work. And in your own life, right, in whatever applications you have, whatever you sell or whatever deals you're in, you can use those lessons of human psychology to make sure that people, when you pitch to them, you sell to them, they want what you have, respond to your message, and mm-hmm. don't get overwhelmed by you and get excited by what you have. And that's why people take money out of their bank account and put it in your bank account.
So very valuable. Let me tell you, we've implemented that in our own practice at Delta Business Services, which is my company. I work a lot with baby boomers, business owners who are looking to sell their businesses. And they're trying to sell. They don't really know exactly how to do it, but they want to retire and start another phase of their lives. Let me ask you this. How can mastering the strong method help them position their businesses for a better selling outcome?
Think about the process of selling your business, right? One, you got to find somebody who's potentially interested in buying it, and I believe people can do that. Then you got to sit down with them and explain what it is about, you know, what you do, how you do it, your value proposition to customers, and your product, right? But you also have to explain to them the business. And what most people do, right, when they get a live buyer, is they overwhelm them with information about the business, mm-hmm. details about the product, a hodgepodge of information about the customers, about the revenue, about the growth opportunities about the business, about the competition. And this is really delivered as information, right? But it's an unformed narrative. It's not in a story, right? So, and most of the time, 90% of the meeting, not only is it not a story, it will be information about the product, what the company does. But in reality, buyers don't care that much at the early stages about what the product is. Okay, they understand it. Oh, so you dig ditches, you repair furniture, you have a 19 Meineke mufflers, you have 11 Burger Kings, you do construction equipment repair, you do general construction, you do computer repair, you do computer installation, right? I mean, you're not manufacturing semiconductors with a brand new intellectual property that was acquired out of Stanford, right? Your business right. does something, and buyers understand that very well. Like if I had a chain of bicycle repair shops and I came to sell it to you, how much would you really need me to explain to you about bicycle repair? About 1 minute.
Exactly.
You go, I get it. Right? Bikes come in, they don't work, your mechanic fixes them, they go back out, you make a 30% gross margin, you try and do as much as possible, you advertise in the local paper and in the yellow pages and on the internet, mm-hmm. and the wheel turns. Right? I don't know anything about bike shops, but I know enough that's a business. So I don't need to know much about the business. I need to know about the financing, right? The finance of the business, mm-hmm. right? What the growth has been, how many employees there are, what the gross margin is, what the competitive nature of the market is, how the business will look 5 years from now if you continue to do the business model, how new technologies like the internet or mobile advertising have been integrated into the business and are affecting the underlying finance, how much capital the business takes to run, and what I should expect to earn as income management can receive as salaries. That's the important stuff, right? Because that's mm-hmm. the stuff that sells a company. What it does, your product, what you do, and how much customers like you is not important in the pitch. So these presentations to buyers are, when I see them, are almost always fall into these errors. Purely informational, too much information, too fast, mm-hmm. unstructured, so not in a story narrative, and almost all the focus on what the product is, and almost none of the focus on the underlying finance. So these are some things you could fix right away very easily when you think about selling your business.
Well, you talk a lot about framing. Can you explain a little bit about what you mean by framing and why it is so crucial to deal success?
Sure. So in the book, and I definitely recommend this because we spend, so people ask me to speak about framing, and I don't think I could speak about it any better than we wrote it in chapter 2 of the book, because the book was a year-long process to write. It's funny. So my agent, when the book published, dear God, drive to some book signings, go to Hollywood, go to West Hollywood, go to Beverly Hills, go to, Reseda, fly mm-hmm. somewhere, go to some book signings, promote this book. I said, no, I don't have to do that. A month later, we check on Amazon, and the ranking is like 40,000. That's not very good ranking on Amazon. And her and the publisher call me up in a panic. Please, Oren, go to some book signings, promote the book. And I go, that's not necessary. They call me up a third time. They say, please, look, we really need you to promote the book. We love the book, but people have to know about it. I said, check Amazon right now. It is number 32 on Amazon. That is better than Twilight, Harry Potter, and many versions of the Bible, right? What you have to do to promote a book is actually write a good book. So I spent about a year on this book alongside a host of researchers, clinical psychologists, and business people, and we really formed this method that is then written in the book. Chapter 2 is framing. So if we think about framing, right, it is the idea. A frame is a perspective. And if you think about it, no business deal can be done where there are two perspectives, right? So you and I are doing a deal. Let's go back to a bicycle shop. I'm selling you a bicycle shop. My perspective is that it's worth $1 million. Your perspective or your frame or the lens at which you look at the deal is that it is worth $500,000. So we have two different frames at this point. Every meeting, every negotiation, every business deal you get in is then the collision of perspectives, right? You think it's worth $1 million. I think it's worth $500,000. This is not going to be a win-win situation. Our lenses, our perspectives, our frames literally collide, right? And one, if a deal is going to get done, one of our perspectives, one of our frames will be the strongest, right? Either you will fall into my frame, which is worth something near $1 million, right, in the frame collision, or your frame is stronger, right? I fall into your frame, which says, hey, it's worth $500,000. If you think, hey, I haven't seen frames working before, then you've never met a three-year-old, okay? A three-year-old goes, I know dinner's in 5 minutes, but I want ice cream now, right? And you go, no, sweetie. You know, we're going to have dinner first, and then we can have dessert, right? And so you have guests coming over, and the three-year-old begins stomping and crying, right? But you want quiet, and you want to be peaceful and show your guests that you have a nice family, and you don't have a lot of drama, and your children are well-behaved, right? And so the three-year-old goes, I want ice cream now, starts screaming, kicking, throwing stuff around, and storming. That is a very strong frame that is hard to break, right? So that frame is, I want ice cream right now, and your frame is, I want quiet, and I want you to eat dinner nicely and have ice cream after dinner. Well, as you know, in the case of a dinner party, the three-year-old's frame is stronger than yours, and it breaks your frame, and you give in order to stop the screaming, stomping, crying. So that is an example of a frame collision in which the stronger frame wins. So the more definitive you believe in your position, and the better you are able to frame it for somebody to see the world through your perspective, through your lens, the more likely the deal is going to be done on the terms you want it to be done, right? So the business of selling a company or selling a deal or selling anything or pitching anything is really framing information for people in a way that shows them your perspective on what you're selling. Okay. It also limits the amount of information. So I use this example in the book. I'll talk about it here. And I love this example. If you've ever walked into a busy restaurant, like a Cheesecake Factory, big, busy restaurant at 7:30 in the evening, and it's just a cacophony of noises, sounds, visual stimulation, it is way too much for your brain to take in all these input, right? And you just become overwhelmed. So you're looking to meet your friends for a beer and a glass of wine after work. They can be 10 feet right in front of you, but there's so much stimulus coming in, you can't see them, right? So this environment is completely unframed. Then you go, okay, well, you start to notice the wait staff. So your brain deframes all of them out of your information stream. It's not them, right? So everybody now sees a bunch of families, a big table of a meeting. You go, it's not them. And you start to chunk down and narrow the frame of possibilities until eventually you see your friends, they're right in front of you, right? So the work of framing is taking all the information that encompasses what your business is, the opportunity, the market, the pricing, everything about you, your background, the future, the past, the employees, like way too much information. It's like a buyer walking into that Cheesecake Factory at 7:30 on a Friday evening. Boom, way too much information. So the job of framing is reducing the amount of information, not increasing it, right? And giving the buyer your view of the world in a very simplified but meaningful way. So this is all abstract talk. I can give you a frame that I think is very powerful, for example, selling a business, right? And that frame goes like, where the framing is the big, let me tell you about the big idea. Even a bicycle shop in downtown Austin, Texas can have a big idea. Okay, just I've never bought or sold a bicycle shop, and maybe it's a bad example because I don't know anything about it, right? But, you know, you could say, you know, here's the big idea. In a city like Austin, which doesn't is small, has an environmental sensibility, and in which the weather is temperate nearly year-round. It is not, and it is mainly not necessary for a car to get around. And we're not Los Angeles. We're not New York. This is not a car culture. The two-wheeled bicycle is really the form of travel that is, you know, most attractive for the culture. And the more that we use bicycles in this city, the more we become known, you know, the world over as, you know, Austin, the place of environmental concern. And it's and to the degree you use bicycles, get rid of you know, your reliance on a car. It's good for the city, it's good for you, and it's good for our economy, right? So listen, I don't know if that's the best, but that is at least a big idea for a bicycle shop, right? From the you know, as I would continue to frame the sale of a bicycle shop, I would say, hey, listen, things are changing today, right? It used to be bicycles were recreational vehicles, but today with the cost of gas, the environmental concerns, it is now permeating every family, every part of societal life, right? If you, if our city continues to adopt bicycles, at, even at the rate that it is going, this shop that we have, for example, would not the square footage we have would not serve our market area. The trend line, the change, because of the sweeping cultural changes, the economic changes, you know, which is really the cost of gas, and the technology changes, right, which are making, you know, better bicycles more affordable. Because of these changes, we see an increased demand. That's a trend line, right? So, so and by the way, that increases your status. Like, people respect people who know what's going to happen in the future with the economics of an industry. Okay. So now we have a big idea. We have a trend line. We're now we're 2 or 3 minutes into a pitch. We haven't even talked about our products, what we do, right, or the specifics. So as we continue to frame out the sale, for example, of a bicycle shop, the big idea, how things are changing technically, sociologically, and economically, and plotting these trend lines, right? And then talking about the problem, right? Instead of just jumping into our bicycles are the best bicycles, we carry the Trek line, we're the only ones in the city that have, that's a solution. Talk about the problem, right? The problem today is if you're a bicycle owner, the repairs of bicycles are quite expensive. So you really need to trust your shop, right? And so really, the problem in terms of running a bicycle shop is building trust into your into the consumers that you're charging them fairly. So the issue is, right, what I see most business owners do, again, and this I would put this in an error, is they talk about their solution before they describe the problem they fix. Always has to be the problem before the solution. Nobody cares about the problems that you solve after you've introduced a solution. Problem first, then solution. It sounds simple and basic, but I see most people get it wrong. So now you see we're building out a framing of information for selling a bicycle business, and it's quite structured, right? And the structure allows you to leave out a lot of information that would be overwhelming, confusing, and limiting in terms of your pitch. So these are some thoughts around frame. And maybe that was more answer than there was question, but in my mind, in my experience, the issue of framing information, building mental frames for people, and structuring information in this way, big idea, what's changing, problem, solution, is fundamental to the sale of any business. And I'll just creep in one more comment. I believe you can sell your business. I believe I could give you a bicycle business, right? And an operating bicycle business, you've never run it, and you know, 30 days later, you will have sold it. I believe I could give you a cement mixing business, a birthday cake decorating business, a ball bearing business, and you would sell it. It's not the issue of can you sell your business, it's at what price, right? And if your narrative is weak, if the story is not compelling, if you can't give mm-hmm. that pitch well framed in a short period of time, you're going to get a low price because you're going to have a limited set of buyers. Right. If you have a limited set of buyers, a weak narrative, right, then you're really going to sell it at asset value and get a low price. So this framing, mm-hmm. narratives, storytelling, and structure are what allows you to drive price. And ultimately, that's what you want, a high price for whatever it is that you've built or that you sell.
No, exactly. A mentor of mine told me that, Keith, you have to stimulate the pain. You have to show yourself as an authority on the problem. And then once you show yourself as an authority on the problem, the solution really sells itself. But you stimulating the pain in that buyer, if you're selling, or in that seller, if you're buying, and keeping up with the stimulus and keep them coming back, that is the holy grail of business. And the worse the pain, the more intense the pain, the more money you can make by executing on it and being the aspirin, so to speak, to that pain. No, exactly.
So I think that's very true. You know, the issue is, though, if you're selling a business or raising money, it's sort of hard. Like, you know, people don't need to spend their money. So look, if let's look at pain situations, right? I'm in my house 2 years ago, our pipes broke, right? And the water started coming up through the floor. The first emergency plumber that we got a hold of didn't have to do much selling, right? We were doing the begging. So pain was at 100. No selling was done, okay? You know,
precisely.
I will drive down there and bring you to my house. I will cook you filet mignon while you're, you know, and your crew, whatever you need, please, I beg you. That was the selling, right? So now you go sort of to a mid-level and you say, well, you know, we're in our building and we need a new heating air conditioning system. It's working okay. It's not that efficient. It's expensive. We should get it replaced, right? So now mm-hmm. you're right. The heating, you know, the air conditioning HVAC salesperson comes in and they got to say, they got to create some pain, which says, hey, look, you know, this mm-hmm. thing could fail at any moment. And then you're going to be buying it on an emergency basis with no, you know, ordering process. That's going to cost you 30, 40% more if it fails suddenly. Mm-hmm. By the way, you know, you're spending a lot on electricity, pain, right? And this isn't a modern system. It's not ECHO. It's not green. It could fail any moment. Your electricity bills are high. So they're creating a bunch of pain. You know, oh, our solution, the XP3000, is environmentally safe. It's very quiet. You know, it's reliable and it's low cost. So that's kind of the traditional sales cycle. The issue is, if you're selling your company, the buyer typically doesn't have a lot of pain and you can't create it. So I think of it more like a cat litter box, not to be, you know, crude. But if you have a cat or have owned a cat, the issue is you cannot convince a cat to go in the litter box. You just have to make it the most wonderful place it could ever imagine to go use the restroom, right? You can't train it like a dog. It is just, you got to make it a wonderful, compelling, nice come do its business. So in the same way, investors or buyers are the same way. You can't sort of create the pain that they need your business. Oh, you don't have a bicycle shop, so you can't make money from repairing bicycles. It's not a pain, right? So what you have to do is you need buyers and investors at that level need to be attracted, and they can't be sold. So the things you do to sell products, in fact, turn financial buyers off, right? Because mm-hmm. they want to have the autonomy to make their own decision. They don't want to be sold. They want to buy, right? So you mm-hmm. need to attract them as opposed to selling them. So I like to think about, you know, making yourself an expert, you know, as you said, by being able to discuss the problem. I think if you want to talk about it from a psychological basis, so I believe it works like this in the mind. When I am describing problems to you, right? Problems, you know, in products or you know, on a company level, your natural defenses are low, okay? Because when people are describing problems to you, you're listening and you believe them. People don't usually lie, right, about problems. It is when you're introducing solutions or selling that the psychological defenses, or what is called hypervigilance, goes high in buyers because they feel like they're being sold. So when you're describing solutions, buyers are defensive. They're hypervigilant, and they're concerned about the veracity or the truthfulness about the information that you're giving them. When you're describing problems, there are no natural defenses to the description of a problem, and so they believe nearly everything you're saying. So it's a tremendous opportunity to develop your authority, your status, and your status as an expert when you describe problems. If you jump right to describing the solution, what it is, what you have, you trigger immediately the natural defenses of a buyer.
You talk a lot about status and jettison the concept of building rapport. Tell us about the distinction between the two and why you prefer building status.
Most sales books, if you can pick up, that are in the library, on Amazon, there's always this piece about, hey, it's important to build a rapport with the buyer. The salesperson should build rapport with the buyer. The seller should build rapport with the investor. So I kind of ask the question, why, right? What does rapport do for you? So rapport does is it gets somebody to like you, right? Hey, Heath, was this a picture of your sister? She went to Chicago Northwestern. That's terrific. One of my brother also went there. Maybe they went the same year. Oh, you love the Chicago Bears? I love the Chicago Bears. Can you believe that Jay Cutler is still the quarterback? Like, when are we going to get a real quarterback? When are we going to go, 8-3 like we deserve, right? When's the Super Bowl coming out? Oh, man, the winter was so cold last year. Maybe it'll be more temperate this year, right? These are the kinds of things. Oh, do you vacation in Miami? My family vacations in Miami, right? I love the radio. Don't you hate a TV when, it's so much confusing? I love the form factor of a radio. You can just listen, absorb information. It's terrific, right? All these things are the kind of things you might say to build rapport. The reason we do it is because we want people to like us. And if they like us, they're more likely to buy. The issue is people are not going to give you – maybe if you're selling a bicycle, guy likes you, goes, yeah, it's $380, it's $3,000, maybe he buys it. You're selling a company. Nobody's going to give you $1 million, $2 million, $5 million, $50 million because they like you, right? Mm-hmm. They're going to give you money because you have established credibility. You are high status. You have a great value proposition. The numbers that you are promoting – feel credible, and they feel credible because you're a credible person, and nobody is going to say, here's $50 million, we really like you, okay? So rapport doesn't do much for you in deal making, okay? And certainly you shouldn't be a not likable person. But what it does do is it chews up a lot of time. So now we go into the time. You walk in a room to meet a buyer. You're selling your company. We're selling a bicycle chain of bicycle shops for $1 million. You walk in the room, right? What I believe, after hundreds of thousands of experiences, meeting investors, meeting buyers, you've got 15 to 20 minutes of attention from them.
Right.
Okay, the span of human attention is about 20 minutes. Mm-hmm. TED Talks are 18 minutes long, and your own comedian sets are about 20 minutes long at the outset. If you go to the Laugh Factory on Sunset Boulevard, you see lots and lots of things that are chunked at 20 minutes, and that is because the naturally forming length of human experience is 20 minutes. If you think back to your calculus or algebra classes in high school or grade school or college, internally there, 50 minutes is 30 minutes too long. You lose attention. Mm-hmm. So in my experience, you've got this 20 minutes of attention to sell your deal, your chain of bicycle stores to the buyer before he starts to fade and starts to think about his vacation and the new wife that he's planning to get and the car and the house and all the other stuff that are distract us from business. So he's got about 20 minutes to pay attention to you, maybe less. If you spend 5, 6, 7, 10 minutes, sometimes I see 15 minutes on chit chat, rapport, then you have that much less time to make your pitch to that buyer. Rapport chews up valuable time in which the investor could be paying attention to what you're selling. So I much prefer, look, you don't want to be mean to people. We don't want to be rude to people. But I think spending 7, 8, 9, 10 minutes on building rapport, complete waste of time. You know, it's likely that you're likable in the beginning. And people, what you want is people to want what you have, not to like you. Nobody buys anything because they like it. Oh, I bought this amazing, you know, Land Cruiser because I liked it. I bought a $10,000 bicycle because I liked it. You know, I decided to go, you know, to marry this woman, to choose this job, to go to this college because I liked it. You don't hear that, right? You hear people say, I go to Hawaii because I love it there. I married this woman because I dated, you know, many people, but this is the woman that I truly love. This is the love of my life. That's why we got married and committed. People commit and spend money and commit and buy things because they want it and because they love it, not because they like it. Rapport only develops like. That's why I'm not in love with it.
And you've also talked about eradicating neediness. Because you said that neediness creates fear in people and that you should avoid seeming needy in your presentations. And this is something that I see a lot of young entrepreneurs who are new, they're de novo. I see them doing, I see them exuding a bit of neediness. Can you elaborate on that a little and give us some advice on how to exercise the demon of neediness?
Yeah, so I can definitely recommend you know, ways to eradicate neediness, to not seem so needy, to hold what you have in some scarcity, right? But I think it's good for us to dig back into human history to understand for 2 minutes where neediness, the sense of neediness came from, where the emotion or the feeling came from, and why it generates fear in people. So if you think back 50,000 years ago, 60,000 years ago, when the Homo sapiens, the upright, hairless apes that we are, you know, dropped out of the trees into the African savanna and started running across the plain doing a couple things, you know, looking for something to eat, looking for something to someone to mate with, and looking for somewhere to sleep during the evening, right? And so almost everything was scarce, food, women, and fire, right? So if I came up to you and I said, I need something that you have, you had no surplus, okay? Mm-hmm. If I needed something that you had, it immediately created massive fear within you because you didn't have anything to give away, right? So need is a – because of our history through time, it is only recently, say in the last 2,000 years, maybe 1,000 years, that we as human beings have had surplus. So if I come over and say, hey, I need some sugar, I need some flour, can I borrow your car? Hey, can I borrow your lawnmower? You have enough surplus that you're able to give it to me without massive sacrifice. There is a surplus in our lives. This is the first time in human history for the 49,000, you know, the near 75,000 other years that we've been walking the planet, there has not been surplus. That is something new. And so that is why when somebody is needy, they want something you have, it creates immediate fear in you, right? And so when people are fearful of you, they back away. So so for example, you can just in your mind – you can say to yourself, if I walk up to a potential customer and say, hey, look, my quota is down this month. I really need this sale, right? Then that creates fear in them automatically. They back away and they say, yeah, you know, I'm sorry. So neediness creates fear, right? And as we know, scarcity creates desire, right? So you may be looking at a car, you know, on a Toyota Camry. They've got one red one left. You're sort of looking at it. And the salesman comes in and says, hey, I'm taking an order from another customer right now over the phone, right? And suddenly that item became scarce, and all of a sudden you want it. Right. Scarcity creates desire and demand. So neediness and scarcity are exact opposites of each other. Okay.
All right.
So whenever you're communicating neediness to buyer, They don't feel like there's any need to make a decision, and they're in control of the sales conversation. If we think about a practical way to eradicate neediness, right? Most sales conversations go like this, whether you're selling a company, you know, the bicycle shop that we've been discussing here, come in, hey, Heath, I really appreciate you setting aside some time to meet with me. I'm very excited to tell you about my bicycle shop, and I hope that you become interested in it. I've prepared a great presentation for you today, and if you really like it, as I think you will, I believe you'll be the right, you know, buyer for it. And if you do decide that you don't want to move forward as a buyer, I'll bend over backwards to make you happy. And again, I really appreciate your time today. Right. So that's the typical start that I've seen 100 times over. Right. Mm-hmm. What does that communicate?
Right.
Neediness. I have limited options. I need your money, and I'm going to do whatever I need to do. Whether it's discounting, giving you special terms, giving you as much mm-hmm. time as you need. I have no scarcity. I'm needy. You have all the money. And basically, I will do a dog and pony show, dance around, stand on my feet, light my feet on fire, jump around on my hands, juggle, do whatever's necessary to win your attention and to hopefully win the prize of your money. So that's the way mm-hmm. it's typically set up, and that is what communicates neediness. Thank you. Mm-hmm. I appreciate. I'll give you as much time as you need today. I really hope you like it. I've prepared a special presentation for you. If you don't like the price, maybe I can make some adjustments, give you some special terms. That is all communication of neediness. Puts the buyer in control, makes the buyer afraid of you because he believes you need what he wants, and neediness really kills deals. So what's the fix for it? So the natural fix is this, right? So if you think about a BMW dealership, right? When they get their allocation of the brand new M3, they only get two or three of them, right? So
right.
if you walk onto a BMW dealership, right, and you if you call them, you say, I want to make an appointment to come see an M3. They're like, yeah, I mean, they're all sold. No appointment is necessary. You can come down here and see if we have any floating around, right? No appointment.
Mm-hmm.
They're not needy. You come down there
right.
and you say, hey, I'm really interested in the M3. And they go, okay, yeah, here. You go, can I test drive it? They go, well, not really. Everybody knows what this car is. No test drive necessary. If you want it, you want it. If you don't, you don't. You know, we don't care. And you go, okay, well, I want it. And then you go, oh, it's $74,000. You know, I was thinking of paying a little bit less. You know, would you guys take $69,000? And they go, $69,000? Go kick rocks. We're not selling it.
Mm-hmm.
These are salespeople who are not needy, right? So that is the pattern of communication. You see, we don't have neediness.
Right.
So if we think about it, how can you, right? So that's how non-neediness works in the real world and how people communicate. So how can you pattern that communication for your own sales, right? And how can you not communicate neediness? So let's say, you know, we mm-hmm. sell copiers, we have 30 of them in the warehouse, and we know we need to sell them, and we want the buyer's money, and we really don't have scarcity. We've got a bunch of them, they need to be sold. But I think, you know, there's ways to eradicate neediness or communicate non-neediness in a presentation. You know, you're familiar with it from, you know, my material, but I can, the way I would start off that presentation, for example, is, I'm glad I could make some time to visit with you today, right? I'm
right.
very busy. We got scheduled by my assistant, and it sounds like she found a magic hour out of nowhere, terrifically excited that we were even able to find some time for you. Okay? That's a lot better than thank you so much for making the time to see me. Glad I could make time for you. Now, you don't have to say it in a mean tone of voice like I'm saying it. You can say it very nicely. Oh, my goodness, we're so busy. Like, you called. We decided to get together. My assistant was really somehow magically able to find this hour. By the way, I've got an hour today, after which I probably have to bounce. I couldn't stay any longer than that. So given that we've got limited time together, right, so we're introducing
mm-hmm.
scarcity, given that we've got limited time together, you know, rather than discuss skiing, snowboarding, mountain biking, you know, stuff I love, you love, and if we become customer, vendor, we can talk about that stuff for hours. Rather than spending time on that, why don't we just kick this meeting off? Does anybody need fluids in or out? If not, I'm going to give you my presentation for about 20 minutes. Then I'll turn it over to you. You can tell me a little about yourself, and then we'll decide together if we're right for each other. And if we are, we can choose some next steps. See,
right.
In that case, we're not saying, thank you so much. I really appreciate it. I hope you like what I have. I'm going to give you a presentation. If you do like it, you know, all that other stuff. And so that kind of opening, which I just gave you, is really interesting. It does so many things simultaneously. It raises your status, right? Because a buyer hears that goes, good Lord, I'm in the hands of a professional. I can sit back for a moment, relax, and feel like I'm going to get pitched correctly. Like, I wish I could even pitch myself. Two, it sets a time constraint. So when you have a time constraint, people pay attention. Okay, so they know it's not going to be a if you say, you know, I'm going to, in about the next 15 or 20 minutes, I'm going to tell you about our business, what we have, how we do it, the upside, the downside, the specifics of it, mm-hmm. we compete with, and what the features and benefits of the product are. So now there's a time constraint, and the buyers are going, oh my God, when is this presentation going to end? So now he's willing to pay attention to you. Your status is high because you're a professional. You know how to manage a meeting, and most of all, you're not needy. Right. And it's a novel experience because most salespeople don't know how to kick a meeting off with that level of seriousness and gravitas. And so it's a novel experience, and novelty makes people want to pay even more attention to you to see what's going on. Right. So these are the real advantages, eradicating neediness and some methods to kick off a meeting without supplicating or making the buyer feel like he's the most important person in the relationship. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. And this is why you're a master. You show students. I want to talk a little bit about pitch mastery here because we are getting to the end of the hour.
Sure, yeah.
Pitch mastery is your course. And what I love about pitch mastery is it's vertical time with Warren. People can prepare their pitches. They can submit their pitches and get them reviewed by your team and get professional criticism and fixes on how people can better structure their pitch and better deliver their pitch and win the deal. Talk a little bit about pitch mastery here in the few remaining minutes here, and then I'm going to give everyone your book and your contact information, okay?
Oh, sure. Yeah, I'd love to discuss pitch mastery. Probably my publisher and the folks get mad at me when I talk for 40 minutes and I don't mention the products we have. Pitch mastery is certainly an important part. So here's what happened, right? So I've helped hundreds of companies raise hundreds of millions of dollars of money. So when the largest ad agency in the world said, we want to go pitch Budweiser for business, they call me up and they say, help us prepare for this pitch to win the Budweiser mm-hmm. account. $238 million account. So I've done this dozens and dozens and hundreds of times. Eventually, we sit back and we said, you know, for every new pitch that we do, 90% of the preparation is the exact same process over and over and over again. So finally, we said, you know, it's only that last 10% that's the custom part. So, mm-hmm. so finally, we sat back and we filmed the training it takes to prepare a pitch to sell a company, to pitch for services, to sell insurance, to sell wealth management, to sell copiers. In fact, we've sold how to raise money for charities. So the process of preparing and structuring that pitch is the same for all of these things. So pitch mastery is the prepared training and templates and tools that we use ourselves to prepare for any important pitch or presentation. And so now we give anybody, you know, who has a couple dollars, the ability to buy the exact same tools, training, and template we use for every new client. So if you go to pitchmastery.com, it spells mm-hmm. it out in exact detail, the tools we have to give you to prepare for a sale of a product, the sale of a service, the sale of a company, or to raise money. And it spells it out in details, you know, exactly. So that's where, if anybody's interested in raising money, selling their company, or getting better at the stuff that we talked about here, you read Pitch Anything and you go to pitchmastery.com, and we'll help you get super smart about how to do this stuff.
And it gets my highest recommendation, which I've only given out 7 times. It has helped me immensely in my own business. I cannot recommend it highly enough. Listeners, if you want to get better at selling, pitching, closing deals, go to pitchmastery.com, get the book pitchanything.com. And Oren Claff, I want to thank you, my friend. Thank you for being on the Business Exit Roundtable. You are a master. You are a gentleman. And we will have you back soon. Thank you so much, and God bless you.
Thanks, Heath. I appreciate it. Okay, talk to you soon.
Take care. Bye-bye.
How about that interview with Oren Claff? Isn't he something? Never a dull moment with Oren. And to reemphasize, once again, the name of his book is Pitch Anything. It's a bestseller. It's fantastic information, wonderful material that you can start using and applying in your business right away. Our promise to you, our listeners, is to bring you real experts with real solutions on today's business problems. And this guy is a master. You have to check him out. Go to his website at pitchanything.com. You can get the book there. You can also get the book at amazon.com. And for those of you who want to sharpen your skills with respect to pitching, selling, closing deals, the website at pitchmastery.com is phenomenal. I'll tell you, it's a treasure trove of information. Sign up for his webinars. He does maybe one webinar every couple of months. And let me tell you, fantastic information, practical. You can use it. You can apply it right away. So that Oren Claff, you're a class act, buddy. Thank you so much for being on our show. And that's going to do it for our show today. I want to thank you for listening in, and I hope that you heard something helpful and useful that you can take action with in your future planning. A big thank you to my guest, Oren Claff, and to our sponsors, and to my entire team at Delta Business Services and Exit Coach Radio Network. And if you're a business owner who wants to exit successfully, you can learn how to do it by visiting www.deltabusinessservices.com or call 210-369-4161 for more information. Remember, we update our content daily, so please visit us often and tell your friends to find us at exitcoachradio.com. I'm Heath Fronson, host of the Business Exit Roundtable. We're here to help you, our hero, the private business owner, with ideas, tips, and precautions so you are well planned and get what you're going after. As we sign off, as always, cheers, everybody, to your exit success.
Thanks for listening to the Business Exit Roundtable with Heath Fronson, featuring real experts with real ideas about planning for a spectacular life that's more exciting and prosperous. Set your calendar and make the appointment to join us again next week when we'll solve more common problems faced by business owners who want to exit on the Business Exit Roundtable.